David, my name is Tom Green. I'm with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. And I'm not even sure how this sits. Okay. And this will be relatively informal. And what we're about is the statute that created our commission asked us to make an inquiry into what were the causes of the crisis. So probably this morning's activity will really focus in part on specific things that we want to ask you about vis-a-vis Goldman, and then more general policy questions that may relate generally to your perspectives, because we do view you as an expert on many of the markets that we've been trying to focus on. So some of these will be huge, big questions, and you know, answer them as you feel comfortable, because we want to get your perspectives and insights. We're not doing this under oath, so it's not a real deposition type thing, but I do need to advise you that we are covered by something called 18 U.S.C. 1001, which basically says bad idea to tell a federal investigator something that's not totally correct, but I'm sure your counsel has advised you about this. We are recording.
Even if you weren't, I'm not really big on telling people things. So
I didn't think that. But we are recording, so try and answer verbally. Okay. You know, I will try and prompt you if you nod or something like that. But if I don't remember, if you would kind of keep that in mind as well. Okay. If for any reason any of our questions are not clear, or you go, what the heck is that? You know, just pipe up and tell us that doesn't make any sense, and we'll obviously rephrase. If you need a break, let us know. You want to talk to your lawyer, let us know. I understand there are breakout rooms, so we're all about. And I'm joined by various members of our staff. Tom Stanton. Tom is with our research group. He'll ask some questions probably at the end. He's very interested in governance and risk management, so be prepared. Bob Hinckley on my left will be asking a number of questions about risk management as well, probably working off some of the documents that you're already aware of. And then Carl McCartan is one of our financial analysts, and he's going to be helpful. He may ask a few questions, but may or may not. So let me turn generally to your background, and that is just briefly, what was your education after high school?
I went to Union College in Schenectady, New York, and then Harvard Business School.
Great. And employment history after college?
I spent 2 years between college and business school working for Pricewaterhouse. And since business school, I've been here.
Great. And briefly, what were your major posts here at
I spent 12 years in investment banking. I was in an area that had various names. It was called private finance. It was basically a part of investment banking where we did more complicated non-public financings, leasing, project financing, transactions like that. And in 1992, I came over to the support side of the business, officially ran the Treasury Department, then Treasury and Controllers, various incarnations. Then I was named the Deputy CFO, and then in 1999, I think I became the CFO, and I have been since.
Okay. And let me turn to Lisa. I'm going to ask you sort of two.
So far, these are good, easy questions. I can do this.
No, you're smooth. You're doing well. Just briefly, I'm going to ask you some questions about first collateral calls, particularly vis-a-vis AIG, and then some big picture questions about derivatives and the company's role with respect to derivatives. But first, turning to collateral calls. One of the major questions is, of course, Goldman and AIG, Goldman and others with respect to collateral calls. And what was your role in those sets of discussions? I understand you had some personal knowledge and then personal experience, and then presumably you were supervising some of the aspects of those collateral calls.
Right, but it was really my involvement, as best I remember it, was pretty minimal. Until the collateral disputes became large enough that it would hit my radar screen. So collateral call process is a normal process here. We have lots of collateral calls with lots of counterparties. The way we do most of our transactions, we would have collateral going back and forth, and calling for collateral is just a normal process that goes on every day at Goldman Sachs that I would have basically no involvement in whatsoever. I would only get involved if we had people who we didn't feel were giving us the collateral payouts, and only if it got to a size that was substantial.
Okay, and briefly, who in the organization or where in the organization would that collateral call activity be located?
I think, and I'm not positive, but I'm pretty sure it's largely in operations. It's a very largely operational process.
Okay. And do you recollect when this was elevated to your level?
I don't.
Okay. Do you have any first recollections of when you started getting involved?
No. I don't, actually.
Is this AIG?
You're talking about AIG.
AIG, correct.
AIG. I'm sorry. I assume that's what you're talking about. I can't remember the what I'll call the aha moment. The, you know, okay, let's sit down and talk about it. I just don't remember what the first conversation was about AIG.
Okay. Do you have any recollections of it that come to mind?
I have recollections of it ongoing, but I just couldn't tell you when the first time we sat down and talked about it was.
Okay. And do you have any recollection of what those first conversations really amounted to, if you can't, even if you can't recall specifically when they occurred?
I don't remember specifically, but they would have been largely around, you know, we have large collateral groups of AIG. We feel they owe us a lot of money, and it was probably more of a posting than anything else.
Okay. To the extent you recall, and you may have already answered this, was this set of collateral calls, because they were quite large vis-a-vis AIG, was this part of a broader effort to go short for the company in terms of RMBS and CDOs, or was this just a day-to-day, they owe us money based on our marks kind of situation?
Day-to-day, they owe us money based on our marks.
Okay. And let me turn to this question of setting of marks, which I presume is within your direct purview. Would that be correct?
Well, it would be within the purview that reports to me.
That seems fair. And do you have any specific perspectives in terms of how those marks were set vis-a-vis CDOs and RMBS? I mean, those are fairly complex securities, and people talk about mark to model or mark to mystery, et cetera. So this is not without its challenges.
Right.
Were you involved in trying to determine how Goldman would set its marks vis-a-vis those kinds of
details of how we would mark them? No.
Okay.
No. The way we mark our securities, all securities, and some are simpler and some are more complicated, but the way it works is, this is really across the firm, our traders are responsible for marking things. It's, you know, they in a way own the securities, they own the marks, and our controllers department, which is completely independent, is responsible for verifying those marks. And they use a whole variety of tools. Obviously, there are some things that are quite easy. If it's a public equity, you get a
Wall Street Journal.
It's easy, Wall Street Journal. And if it's a less liquid security, there's a whole variety of methods that we use. Looking, of course, the easiest being similar securities. You try and sometimes break down securities into their component parts and see if, even though a security or a derivative or some other type of position is not trading, you might be able to break down to 4 or 5 or 10 factors and then see if those factors are trading in some other way. And so you can then, so there's a whole variety of methodologies that we use to verify prices.
Okay. Let me represent to you, I've seen documents, for example, there's an email from Mr. Sparks, who you probably are aware of, who in passing suggested that with respect to the marks vis-a-vis securities that AIG had written CDS on, that the controller's office used a six-factor or six-bucket kind of approach, and his traders were using a set of variables that exceeded 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any recollection of what that looked like and what the debate might have been between those two approaches?
I don't.
Okay. Does it make sense that the traders would have something that would have 1,000 variables in it?
I don't know what he meant. I don't know what he was
talking
about.
All right. Fair enough. And just briefly, and this is sort of a high-level question in terms of marks, is there any ordinary practice with respect to how you price securities? I mean, at the same time, just to set this up, you are making collateral calls on AIG based on marks with respect to certain kinds of securities and tranches of securities. You are also selling at least similar kinds of securities. Are those in lockstep? If the marks go down, the price goes down?
And we own similar types of
securities. You do, of course. So, yeah.
And yes, basically the policy is pretty much that where we give our clients marks is the same as the marks on our books and records. So if we own a security, and I'll come back to AIG in a second, we own a security, and we also have a transaction with a client, we call, and it goes down, so we call collateral, we also take a loss on the security that we own. And with AIG, again, there's exceptions to everything, but largely, the positions we had with AIG, we had very similar positions on the other side with other counterparts. So while we were calling for collateral from AIG, we were posting collateral to other counterparties on those same loans.
Okay, fair enough. Now there were, and I'm curious about your recollection, there was to-ing and fro-ing, if you will, between AIG and Goldman. Do you have any recollections of that, specifically with respect to the appropriateness of your marks?
I know there were a lot of conversations about that.
Do you have any recollections of any specific points that they wanted to make and your responses?
Their general point of view is they thought our marks were too low, and we thought they weren't.
Right.
That's why there was a dispute.
Sure. But at least in some of their email traffic, they seem to suggest that there may have been some specific things. One example of that would be, Goldman is setting its marks based on a market which is in free fall. There's fire sale pricing in this particular space. Therefore, these marks can't be correct. Was that something you heard from them or
we heard,
bubbled up to you?
A lot of different reasons why they thought our marks were too low, that other people had higher marks, that we were taking into account factors they didn't account, that the securities would be fine in the end. They had a lot of different reasons why they thought our marks were too low.
Okay. And as I understand the course of dealing, neither firm, correct me if I'm wrong, neither firm asked for an arbitrator? I mean, there are provisions in the standard contracts you could have both used but did not. What was your perception of why nobody pulled the trigger?
The provision in the contract, and again, I'm not an expert in this, and others here may know more than I do, is for what's called a dealer pull. I don't believe there's an arbitration provision in the document. I believe it's a dealer
pull. I'll defer your perspective.
It's what you can do. And again, somebody checked the contract, you just not positive. And that is you have to go out to a series of dealers, you get various bids or various marks, and you drop the high and the low, you put the average, it's some type of dealer pull. And neither one of us ever really wanted to do that. It's a pretty big step. It's not done very often. It has bad implications in the markets. Neither company really wanted to do it, although we got close a couple of times doing it. Plus, it takes a long time to get done.
Mm-hmm. And why does it look bad in the market?
It shows that there is a big dispute between two counterparts.
Oh, so you can't do this discreetly and say, what are your prices? You've got to reveal the competing positions?
You do it discreetly. But nobody has confidence it will be kept discreet.
Okay. Now, at some point, as I understand it, you got personally involved with the CFO of AIG. Could you describe that?
I recall one conversation I had with the CFO where I told him basically that we had this dispute and I thought their marks were incorrect and that I thought, as the CFO, he should look into that. And it was a pretty brief conversation. It was as simple as that.
Okay. Do you have any recollection of one or more conversations in which basically you might have suggested that essentially the two companies might take a split the baby approach? Your collateral call was $4 billion, let's make it $2 and call it good for the moment or some version of that?
That's where we ultimately settled out. And this was, again, I don't recall the timeline of this, but we ultimately had a meeting, I just don't remember the timing at all, at some point where they agreed to post additional collateral, we agreed to accept that, we agreed to take collateral that was less than we thought we were owed, and that we would continue to discuss where we were. And that was kind of a methodology we used for a while after that.
Okay. To the extent you know, as you're in the process of making these collateral calls, do you know if Goldman ever went short in the market vis-a-vis AIG?
Well, when you say short, it's an interesting.
It's a big. It covers a lot of ground.
Because remember, when we had the collateral disputes, that means we were owed money by AIG in our view. Okay, so if we asked for $2 billion, they asked $1 billion, they owed us $1 billion. Our risk management is such that we have limits on how much credit exposure we're prepared to take on AIG or any other counterparty. We set these limits. And so the collateral disputes were well over the limit we were prepared to take on AIG, and therefore we bought a lot of protection on AIG to protect ourselves. In effect, that's going short. It's going short. So, it was largely through CBS contract, but that's basically a short position in AIG. So, yes, we had a, call it a short position equal to the amount that they owed us under the collateral disputes, pretty much at all times.
Can you essentially recall, what was the limit vis-a-vis AIG?
The limit was pretty close to zero for a while. I don't know exactly what it was, but it was pretty close to zero. We had a margin threshold with them that changed based on their credit rating. The margin threshold, it was either $300 or $400 million. Margin threshold means they didn't have to post collateral until they owed us more than that amount. And that amount was either $300 or $400 million, I can't remember which one, until they got downgraded. The margin threshold went to zero if their rating fell below a certain amount. And I believe, again, I don't know if, I should just say, I don't actually know what the limit was.
Yeah, just to the best of your recollection. Yeah. I mean, obviously, these are very detailed kinds of matters. So. Okay. All right. And do you, so I think what you suggested to me was that most of your short position was in the form of CDS. Did you also short their stock?
I believe at some point we might have had some shorts on their stock, again, as part of the amount they owe us. There are various ways you can hedge when someone owes you money. You can be short the bonds, short their CDS, or short commercial paper, you can short any part of their capital structure in different amount. And I do believe, I have recollection of some conversations with the guy. Let's step back now. Normally, I would have no idea what we were using to hedge various credits. So we have these limits on lots of companies. We have a net credit limit. There's a desk that's responsible for the hedges in place. What I would get is, okay, are we complying with our limits? And so as long as they were hedging, it's fine. I would very rarely look at what the hedge was. Here, because it got to be such a big number, I would be a little bit more involved. Again, not with the specifics. I recall a couple of conversations, not in any specificity, that as part of what they're doing, they had some small shorts on the AIG stock. And frankly, it was largely because people were worried at the time that their stock got hit pretty badly, that it could snap back very quickly. And even though being short it was a hedge, it's not necessarily a perfect hedge. In fact, in some ways, it could be a very bad hedge. It could be a place where you could lose a lot on both sides if you have that as a hedge. And so I believe we didn't have it very much. I believe we didn't have it very long. But I think at some point, we did have some shorts on the stock.
Okay. Would it be fair to say that your best understanding at this point is that the combination of CDS and whatever shorting took place in the stock market, that that matched the shortfall you saw in terms of the collateral you were owed by AIG?
Yes, pretty close. Okay. Yes.
Now, I'd like, essentially outside the glare of the cameras, I'd really like to get a sense of the story with respect to Goldman's position, even if AIG had not been supported by the federal government. Mr. Blankfein was quite adamant that they could well, that the company was completely hedged and did not need the billions it got from the federal government through the AIG bailout. Could you walk me through what the basis for that claim might be?
Okay. So, as far as our, I want to be careful what I say because it's.
Please, I'm just trying to understand here. So.
As far as our direct exposure to AIG goes, and I can give you specific, there's a specific point in time I remember quite well. So, the day before the government came in and made their investment in AIG, our net exposure to AIG was zero. So, our direct exposure. So, if AIG had gone, let's say, all the way and had declared bankruptcy, vis-a-vis our exposure to AIG on that day, we would have lost zero. Okay? So, the reason is, and I'll give you round numbers here. We can get exact numbers, but round numbers, AIG, we had a collateral call to AIG of $10 billion. So they owed us $10 billion under these contracts. Mm-hmm. We had $7.5 billion of collateral, and we had $2.5 billion of protection, largely CDS protection on AIG. The CDS was largely with counterparts, which were major financial institutions, all of whom we had collateral with as well. Again, just to step back, we do lots of trading with the other big financial institutions, so with Morgan Stanley, JP Morgan, B of A, and almost all of that amongst all of the various financial institutions is done with a zero margin trigger. So we basically pass collateral back and forth every day because there's so much interaction that none of us are willing to take gigantic credit exposure to the other, and you don't know what's going to happen on a given day because there's thousands of trades going back and forth. So basically at the end of every day, we send collateral, they send collateral. So the exposures are basically zero. So the CDS that we had were mainly with the other large financial institutions, and all of it was collateralized. So on that day, we had zero exposure. If they had filed, we would have had the $7.5 billion collateral, we would have collected on the CDS, zero. We would have been net zero. So I think that's what Lloyd meant, that's what I've said repeatedly, that our exposure to AIG was zero. Now, all that being said, had a, and again, think back and remember the week it was and what was going on and how fragile the whole financial system was, if AIG had filed, I think it would have been very bad for the financial system. And we're certainly not immune to that. So I can't tell you it would not have had a bad effect on Goldman Sachs and every other financial institution, non-financial institution in the country and maybe the world. But as far as our direct exposure to AIG, it was zero.
Okay. With respect to the $2.5 billion approximately in CDS you had with other large financial institutions, what was the reference point? Was it on AIG stock, AIG failing, AIG...
I don't know what the reference securities were,
okay,
but I believe they only paid if AIG defaulted. So CDS, when you have a CDS contract on somebody, the price of the CDS varies based on the market's view of how likely it is that they will default. So CDS can get more or less expensive, but CDS actually only pays off if they actually default. So you could turn around and sell the CDS to somebody else at a varying price, depending on, again, depending on whether what the likelihood of default is. And so, you know, if somebody's credit spreads widen because the market is viewing it as a more likely kind of default, then your CDS gets more valuable. But in the end, you only get paid on the CDS if they actually default. Because it's a credit default swap. Basically, what happens is if they default, you take the defaulted bond, give it to the counterparty, and they pay you for the bond.
So, okay, interesting. So, would it be the case then, given what you just described to me, that you had pay-as-you-go CDS with AIG, but not pay-as-you-go CDS vis-a-vis the, with respect to the $2.5 billion otherwise?
When you say pay-as-you-go.
That's, you know, if the value of the security goes up or down, that was one of the issues.
Same thing with the transactions with AIG. Again, remember what I said, we have the CDS with counterpart X, right? The CDS goes up in value. They have to post margin with us. They don't owe us the money. They have to pay us the margin. If it never pays off, we have to give them back the margin.
Right, of course.
Same thing with AIG. AIG didn't have to pay us anything, but they had to post the margin in case they had to pay us, in case of that, because it was getting closer and closer to the likelihood of default. Therefore, they had to give us the margin so that when they ultimately had to pay it off, you know, let's say it was, you know, $1 billion, and they had given us $500 million of collateral because it was marked at 50, then ultimately this was default, they only had to give us 50 more. They didn't have to give us all 100 more. If in the end, even though you thought it was getting worse and worse, ultimately they paid off, we would have to give them back 50. Because then they would have fine. We never would have had to pay off on the CDS. So it wasn't they owed us under the CDS, they owed us margin in case they had to pay us under the CDS.
Okay, so it's sort of a post versus pay kind of distinction.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
Got it. We use Gary Cohen, our general counsel, who just joined us.
He's one of us, too. both John Castle and Gary Cohn.
That's
what I meant. I said we had one of those.
Okay, good. That was most helpful. Let me turn to a different set of, and this will probably be at an even higher level of abstraction. But
if it's helpful to you, by the way, on our website, because of all the focus on AIG, all the numbers and the presentations on that topic are publicly available and all there, I believe. I haven't looked at them for a long time because they've been there for so long.
No, they're there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it might be helpful.
Terrific. Thank you. Let me turn generally to derivatives. I just want to, obviously Goldman is one of the most employed, arguably the most important derivatives trader in the world, candidly, but our understanding is that Goldman is a world market leader in derivatives. Is that your understanding as well? I mean, you can parse that
in number. I would have said we're a world market leader, not the world market leader. I put us, JP Morgan, Deutsche Bank, probably B of A, Citi was, I don't know if they still are. I mean, you take the 10 biggest financial firms, certainly we're one of the top five. I wouldn't even know how to measure who was one and who was three and who was five when you get to the, you know, us, JP Morgan, Deutsche Bank, firms like that. But we're one of them, yes.
Okay, fair enough. Was there, I'm curious initially about the growth of your involvement in derivatives. Was this something that was more or less organic, or was there a point in time, say in the last 10 years, in which the firm said, oh, we've got to get bigger in this kind of derivative or across the board in derivatives?
No, there was not a point in time.
Okay. And just even in broad brush terms, how important are derivative trades to Goldman financially?
I'm only smiling because people have asked that before.
Sure.
It's a very hard question to answer, and I don't, I'm not trying not to answer it. I would tell you if I wasn't going to answer it. Mm-hmm. But derivatives is a funny word. I mean, the derivatives are involved in almost all parts of the financial markets today. And there are so many transactions which could have cash on one side and derivatives on the other side, that I don't know how to measure the financial importance of derivatives. So again, if we do a cash bond for somebody and hedge it with a derivative, the derivative could make money and the bond could lose money, or the derivative could lose money and the bond could make money, and the net is zero, the derivative could make or lose a lot, but that doesn't matter. We don't really care. And we never break it out that way, so we don't look at derivatives versus cash because it's not really relevant to us. So I couldn't calculate for you what the economics of derivatives are. I've actually talked to our people and controllers. We have no idea how we would even start to reach a conclusion about that because it's so intertwined with the rest of our business. We don't have a separate derivatives P&L. Mm-hmm. So we might look at our credit business or our interest rate business, but we wouldn't look at derivatives part of it because it's just intertwined with everything else we do.
Interesting. So there isn't a portion of the firm that's devoted exclusively to derivatives, or are there places where it's more
There are places where it's more, but you know, so like we have an equity derivatives business, which is largely focused on equity derivatives, but take our credit business, cash, credit, and derivatives credit is completely intertwined with each other.
Are there nodes or locations, again, within the firm that handle those trades, or is it just everybody is?
I actually don't know. I think it's very intertwined. I'm sure there are people who do derivatives and people who do cash, but within businesses, it's very, very intertwined.
Okay. Now, some folks suggest, academics and others, that the derivatives marketplace, in all of its various major portions, is largely opaque to customers. Do you agree with that perspective?
I know there is a lot of the derivatives market that is completely transparent. So there are very liquid parts of the derivatives. And again, futures of derivatives, futures trading exchanges, could not be more transparent. And so, you know, derivatives spans a very, very wide spectrum of things. Mm-hmm. Interest rate swaps are quite transparent to people. Currency swaps are quite transparent. Are there some more complicated that might be opaque? I just don't know.
Mm-hmm. And what is there a marker or a quality associated with those particular kinds of derivatives that makes them more transparent? I mean, is it because they're exchange traded, or is it because there's Bloomberg has a special report vis-a-vis them?
I don't know.
Do you think that, if there are some that are transparent, what are the ones that are less transparent?
The more highly structured, one-off type of trades would be less transparent.
And would that?
Maybe less transparent.
Okay. And would that include credit default swaps, or is that?
I think most credit default swaps are quite transparent. Again, I'm not the world expert in this, mm-hmm. but there's a pretty active market in credit default swaps.
And if I were a manufacturing facility in the Midwest, where would I go to sort out what's really available in the CDS market?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
I would just call our desk, so I don't know where they would go.
Okay, all right. Within Goldman, presumably some of this information is not publicly available and would be presumably useful. Is there a system or a process by which Goldman shares information internally on derivative trades and things that may be important? I mean, you may want to break that out by equity, by foreign exchange, etc. But
again, I'm not sure what you mean by shared information on derivatives trades.
Well, I'm assuming that, for example, if there are a series of, just to get it out of the CDS context, if you are writing particular kinds of transactions with respect to, say, currency transactions or interest, that bids and asks, if you will, would be important. I don't know if that's posted on a regular basis, but if I'm presuming that kind of information would be helpful to anyone trading in that market, assuming all of that is true, is there some process within Goldman to make sure that at least all of your traders are aware of what their colleagues down the hall might know that might be of significance to them?
I don't know. I presume there is, but I just don't know.
Okay.
It would never flow into me. It wouldn't be something that I would actually look at.
Okay.
So I don't know. That's why I don't know.
Sure. That seems like a fair point. Let me step back just briefly, because this whole question.
There would be better people, I think, that we can get
right.
to talk to.
Because oh, right.
there are also, just as you might understand, there are all sorts of limits we impose on sharing information so that, you do a bespoke trade for some client, which you've called opaque or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
That information wouldn't be shared, in the sense that you share it the way you're describing, so that someone else and somewhere else in the firm is trying to do something, they would get it. Plus, there's this whole concept which we've tried to figure out what the boundary is, trade information generally.
Mm-hmm.
Even though at some level, since we're trading principally, it's our information just as much as theirs, we actually don't share it in that way, because it seems like you can't do that either. You do get a little color on the market because you see all the trading in some level, but particularized trades, that's not the kind of information you would take from one desk to another. But that's more, the data won't be the right person to talk about.
There are people who are
I'm probably outside my depth and all the details. All I know is a big effort over time has been devoted to working with these kinds of regulators too. Yeah.
Sure.
And so on, trying to figure out what you can share, what you can't share, how all that might work. So it's a complicated topic.
Yeah. No,
thank you. Interruptions, I can give you from time to time stuff, which might be helpful.
Sure, sure. No. I mean, those insights are helpful. I mean, my sort of layperson's perspective, and this may be incorrect, is that there would probably be some folks within the firm that would be firewalled off from certain kinds of information for legal and other reasons. But
yes, not even the firewalling concept, because it's just the concept of client information, the boundary of what you can think of it or do with it. Okay,
right, of course.
Okay. And they're all going to even be, the public side traders. Okay, we wouldn't. I don't believe, based on anything I know about it, just saying, well, that's something we can just share all the information of, I don't know, Fidelity is doing some trade, I think I put Fidelity inside, or some hedge fund is on, you know, doing something, even though everybody else in that whole area, maybe public side traders, it's just not information that I'm aware of that gets shared in any broad systematic way in the way you might describe. And again, I'm not the expert, but I go to these committee meetings where people
sure.
spend time trying to figure out sorts of things, and I hear about it. I'm part of the industry too, and I hear the same sorts of issues just coming up. And so that's just a general concept out there.
Sure, no, that's very helpful. Yeah, because
it's not a Chinese wall thing, it's more of a client information, what can you do with it or not? Because some have argued, obviously, that, well, gee, you're the other side of the trade, you're defying this principle, it's your information as much as their information. And as a legal matter, you may be able to get yourself there just as an aside. It's a client matter of dealing with clients over time. Clients are either more or less interested in you being able to do that. They want the market color from our traders when they talk to them. They like to know what's going on in the market or the salespeople, whoever. On the other hand, whatever they're doing, I'm sure they don't want really shared at some level. So it's a whole separate topic that
yeah.
people
why don't
talk
we,
about.
Why don't we try and find somebody that could be helpful on this?
Right.
I think that would be useful. Because I
can find many people other than me.
Yeah, okay. And we won't carry further. But in terms of derivatives, I mean, this is kind of a step back kind of question. I love your broadest answer. What's your sense of the role of derivatives in the recent crisis? I mean, were they a factor? Were they a plus? Were they a minus?
I think they were no more or less a factor than anything else. I think the term derivatives has taken on a life of its own. But, I mean, yeah, futures are derivatives. The S&P 500 future is a derivative.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's a bad thing. I think it's very, very useful. Many companies who want to raise money, liquidity, very important for every company. You raise money, I'll use Goldman Sachs. We raise fixed rate debt. Our assets are very short term. We swap it into floating rate debt. That's derivative. It's interest rate swap. We want to access, and I'll use we, but it's any, you can pick any company. We want to access the debt markets all around the world to have capacity, but we want most of our funding in dollars. So we do currency swaps. Those derivatives. Derivatives are not a bad thing. Derivatives are, I think, some of the most important risk management tools that people have. And I think it would be very bad for the financial markets if it had derivatives. It would really be a big step back. So the derivatives, were they part of the financial crisis? Every financial instrument out there was part of the financial crisis.
Okay. Let me focus you more specifically on a couple of questions that we're wrestling with, and I'd like your insights and handling. One broad perspective is what are sometimes referred to as naked swaps, which can include naked credit default swaps, CDOs, or synthetic CDOs, or another sort of version of this. With respect to, for example, synthetic CDOs, an argument could go, look, they cross-reference or they reference a real thing. If the real thing fails by $1 billion, and then we've stacked on top of that a synthetic, which is $1 billion, the system faces $2 billion in loss, the second billion because of the synthetic security. And one could argue that that multiplies the loss. And indeed, there are some securities, some of which Goldman has cross-referenced or used 30, 40 times. What, do you have a perspective on that? Is that something that was in play in this marketplace?
Well,
and if so, what was the effect of that?
I believe, and again, I'm not the world's expert on this, so I'm probably not the best person to
yeah.
talk to. But I believe synthetic securities net to zero. So if you buy something which has a reference obligation of an IBM bond, and it means that if, you know, whatever, the IBM bond goes up, I pay you. If it goes down, you pay me. It has to net to zero. I pay, you get. Or you pay, I get.
Mm-hmm.
So it might have, if it goes the wrong way, it might have accelerated the crisis for you, but it would have been better for me. So synthetics, I think, have to, by definition, net to zero.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think they add more risk. They just add more risk to one side and less risk to the other side. Depends who has it. I think, you know, you have to be careful. Synthetics also, again, there are like every other financial instruments, there are detriments and benefits to them. But I don't think, I think they net to zero.
Okay.
By definition.
Let me push back just a tad, because I want to understand.
I want to make sure I start with the caveat. I'm not the world's
expert. No, understood, understood, and that's well taken. But, you know, if you were to, it nets to zero, but one might say that but for the fact that you had the synthetic, the person who was the loser in that synthetic transaction would not have been a loser. He might have lost some other place, but at least there wouldn't have been $2 billion where there used to be $1 billion. Is that good for the economy? Is that a where's the plus in that for the broader public interest?
With first of all, I'm a believer that it's always easy to figure out what you should have done with 2020 hindsight.
Oh, always.
So,
yeah.
I mean, I sit here as Goldman Sachs, and I always wish we had more of what went up and less of what went down. And you know, which we could have synthetically increased whatever went up and synthetically decreased whatever went down. You start with the question of if they could not, whoever they is, have accessed whatever they accessed synthetically, would they have accessed it some other way anyway? And so would you. Another way to think about it is the synthetic is really just another form of leverage. And so, and so if party A that had $1 billion and then did something synthetically so they had $2 billion and lost on that, would they have just, if they couldn't do that, would they have just borrowed 50 cents on the dollar against the first billion and bought another billion? I don't know. So if you take the point of view that companies that got into trouble only had their exposures because they had synthetics, then yes, synthetics made it worse. If you take the point of view that they wanted an exposure of some kind and they got it through synthetics, and if they didn't, they would have gotten it through leverage or some other way of doing it, then I'm not sure it made it worse.
Okay.
But this is a very theoretical, esoterical question that I don't think is answerable.
Yeah, no, but I, your point about this, once you think about this as a leverage set of issues, is interesting, I think. Which actually raises another.
Remember, when this was happening, leverage was readily available and very cheap.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which actually raises another question for me, which is, in the CDS space, at least before the crisis really hit, you could buy CDS on subprime relatively inexpensively, which strikes me as another potential magnification aspect, which may be another version of leverage fundamentally. Any sense of whether that created problems in the marketplace, or is it? I'd just love your perspectives on it.
This is a view, not a fact, but it's pretty clear that very, very cheap leverage of all kinds exacerbated prices.
Would it be your view that that was the major cause, or
no?
What do you think was the major cause?
Mm-hmm.
You can certainly consult with it if you want.
I think there were two major causes of the crisis. I think one was very poor lending standards, which in a way is the flip side of the very, very cheap leverage being available.
Mm-hmm.
So I think very, very poor leverage standards, lending standards, and I think very poor risk management in many institutions. And that very poor risk management, it showed itself in many ways, but I think it was, and again, I should give you the caveat, this is opinion, it's not fact.
I'm asking for your opinion.
I think that the poor risk management was a combination of people forgetting that things happen that you don't expect to happen. And so if you think that it's really, really, really unlikely you could ever lose money on this thing that you have because it's never happened in the past, it probably is really, really, really unlikely, but it's not impossible. and so don't have too much of it. And it showed itself in people doing things that they really didn't know how to do because they saw other people making money doing it and that they weren't prepared to do and they weren't really prepared to risk manage. And I think that it really hurt a lot of firms. So I think those, if you ask me two things, poor lending standards, poor risk management.
Okay, fair point, well taken. Not to lean on my two colleagues, but let me ask one final question in this since we've already pushed into this space. Are there a set of best practices in the risk management arena that you think should be adopted or properly or appropriate to be adopted by firms across the nation? I mean, what are there 10 things, 5 things? What would a good system look like other than AIG set or the Goldman system?
I think you need a lot of things.
Okay.
I don't think it's 5 or 10. I think it's, you know, risk management is a very comprehensive topic. And again, I'm happy to talk for as long as they'll let me, or you let me.
these guys may ask those questions more precisely. But is there, let me ask you the easy one, which would be, is there a statement of best practices or a article or some piece that sort of would capture what you think are the
not that I'm aware of.
Interesting.
There have been documents that have been written, and Greg, you mentioned some of the senior supervisory. There have been a whole bunch of regulatory-driven things on risk management that are quite comprehensive and quite good. Some of the things Jerry's been involved in are quite comprehensive.
I think if you look, it's a history of evolution of best practices and standards. We'd say two core things in risk management are, one, market to market, and have the people who do it be independent, ultimately, who have the final say of the trading side of the firm. And we've had that going back since I've been a partner here, since I got here, it's been forever, like 1992. And what we saw in the crisis, obviously, to our surprise, is various sophisticated firms on Wall Street, apparently some of the risk people were pulling it in the head of their fixed income department. So that's got to be a mistake, okay? In terms of the literature in the area, if you want to look at it, every one of the crises, and I'll use that word broadly, stimulated here certainly a comprehensive study of our risk practices and how can we learn from what just happened. And I can go back through all the different crises since, at least I was here since 92. Each one has engendered a huge upgrade in the amount we spend. Like I think I mentioned when I was watching, we have 1,000 people in the controllers department. Then we have a risk management group, which is filled with lots of people who are just very smart, continuously upgrading their models, and so on. And you've seen our risk management reports, I think, which we give to our risk committee every week, and David, you know, David's the co-chair.
Yes, I've been reading them assiduously, I must say.
Well, no, but I can say, because I was on the risk committee in the group back in 94, and it came out of one of those crimp studies, I call it crimp, it's an acronym where Jerry Corrigan actually chaired some of these things, all the firms. All got together and tried to come up with the, you know, best practices in certain areas, whether it was a result of, for example, the crises in Asia in 98, whether it was the things that happened, at least to us, we look back to 94, where we had a very bad year. And I remember the risk reports we produced then. What do I know? I'm just a lawyer. But they were much thinner. They were much less complete. We didn't have as much in our risk systems. We always discover that maybe we don't have everything we'd like to have there. It doesn't work perfectly. I think you've probably heard our testimony on, you know, a lot of people always want to talk about VAR. Anybody who knows anything about risk knows that VAR is probably the easiest thing to say. The SEC used to require it, still does require you to report it. It's probably an interesting factor to talk about in liquid markets over certain time intervals. But otherwise, there are a whole bunch of other measures you better be looking at, and get back to David's statement about things that, you know, if you look at we talked in Washington a little bit, you look at the mortgage market in particular, it could have been, it wasn't, people weren't dead, but you remember just sort of flatlined. There's like no risk involved at all in holding mortgages for a period of years. Seriously. Then suddenly, it just went off the charts, okay?
Nothing ever happens until it happens the first time.
And the too much is a good thing. You guys know better than we do. You can see some of the firms who decided to keep on their balance sheets the super senior part of their CDS, okay, they blew themselves up. Why? Because they were things that could never lose value.
And they did. That's the two big, that's, you know.
Right.
I mean, we don't talk about other firms, but they're sort of merged and gone now, but that's what you do. But in terms of somebody, I don't, someone writing down the right, clearly the, I think the Federal Reserve Bank and other regulators, since they go around and they look at all the firms and see what they do, they have a much better idea, I suspect, of what they think, certainly, about what the state of, in terms of published event, that's hard to.
Let me just step back for 1 second. Yeah, I'll give you, Greg mentioned at least three things in the thing about risk management, although there's hundreds. First, it probably really encompasses the first 100 in my mind, is liquidity. You look at financial firms over history, the only thing that ever really gets a financial firm in trouble is liquidity. If you lose money, you're sad, but you go in and you try and make money the next day. Take too much credit risk, you're sad, but the only thing that really makes you shut the doors is if you run out of money. So liquidity is king for any financial institution. I believe actually it is for any company in the world, but for financial institution. Second, Greg mentioned that we are, I would almost use the word fanatical, about fair value. We don't understand how you can manage your risk if you don't know the value of your assets. And so marking things to market, we think, is absolutely a critical element of risk management. And the third is what I'll call independence and stature of the risk management organization. And as Greg said, I in a way, naively, because I've told you I've been here in my business my whole career, thought, of course, it's like this everywhere, it must be, that the risk management organization has to be, has to work well with the trading side of business, but has to be completely independent, absolutely independent, and it has to have the stature and the authority to do things. And I think that those are three critical elements of this matter: liquidity, mark-to-market, and independence. Now, again, that's just very, very broad. There are so many other important factors within risk management. I would put those as three kind of top of the list.
Let me just follow up just briefly on liquidity. How do you set an appropriate amount of liquidity for a firm like this, and how do you discipline the firm to stay at that level?
The way we do it, and again, we have a broad range of liquidity policies, but let me give you what I consider probably the most important one. We have something here that we call our global core excess. Our global core excess is really an amount of cash that we have. We have it, we reverse in government bonds, so we earn a little bit on it, but it's basically cash, and we disclose this publicly. So in the last two quarters, our global core excess has averaged over $160 billion, which literally means we have $160 billion of cash. It's very expensive insurance policy because it's not earning anything other than, you know, short-term rate. But again, it's critical. We set that amount on a model that we have called the Model Liquidity Outflow, MLO. So it's GCE versus MLO. This Model Liquidity Outflow, again, it's a very detailed, line-by-line, looking at all potential outflows we think we could have in a very bad scenario. So it's not just contractual maturities of debt. It's, okay, if things are bad, do we think people are going to sell us back our commercial paper or our long-term debt? And even though we're not obligated to buy it back, we know that if we didn't, we'd send a worse signal to the market. So we just assume some amount comes back. It has, you know, tax payments, payroll payments, all kinds of other outflows that could happen way beyond contractual outflows. So we look at what we think the bad things are, and then... So that's kind of the baseline, is that model liquidity outflow, and then we add judgment on top of it. So then, you know, usually what happens is then, you know, the person running the model says, well, I think we need a little bit more, and then the treasurer adds more to that, and then I add more to that, and so we end up, you know, our model liquidity outflow now is, our GCE is probably, it's more than 50% above our model liquidity outflow now, because it's an uncertain time, so we all feel more comfortable having more liquidity. But that's the basic. We start with that model, and we need to have more than that.
Okay.
And interestingly, in September 1998, when we go back, because we backtest these things, what the model liquidity outflow said would happen is largely what happened. It was actually pretty accurate. And so that gives comfort, but we also adjusted for things where it wasn't completely accurate. We learned some other things, so we made some changes to it. Based on some things, and we're always adjusting it based on real events that we see. Mm-hmm. But that's the most important thing we have is really just have a lot of cash and make sure you have enough to get through things. We have other things like maturity of financing and making sure you eliminate as much rollover risk as you can. So, for example, the average maturity of our secured debt, even though it's a financed term, that is over 100 days. The average maturity of our long-term debt, which finances really our investing assets, which probably have a 3-ish year average life, is 7 years. So we always want our financing to be much longer than our much longer than our assets.
Just a clarification, please. When you say you back tested to 1998,
I'm sorry.
I meant
2008. Okay. I'm mixing crises.
Okay.
I meant September 2008.
But
we have another test on the fall of 90. We have one of our risk management tools we use is, we do all kinds of scenario analysis, and one of them is a credit spread widening, which we did back to September 1998, so we call it the fall of 98. So I was thinking of that one. Sorry, next time.
All right. Well, thank you. Let me turn you over to my colleague, who has some more specific questions, I think, on risk management and other related topics.
Thank you. Can somebody at that side of the table identify this document? It came out of the Senator Levin's hearings. It's exhibit number 161, and somebody told me it may have came off your website. Definitely came from here.
That's the white paper.
Yeah, we put that up. This is paper we produced because we were wanting to actually integrate what we thought.
Yeah.
So we wrote it and put it out.
So who's the ultimate author? Is it a committee or when about was it produced?
It was produced the weekend before
Friday.
The hearing.
Yeah.
Okay.
Middle of April. Or Friday night. I think we put it out and it was Tuesday.
Yeah, something like that because it was all. Yeah, but it was produced then. I mean, there's no particular one author.
Yeah,
there's a lot of people involved. You know.
Fair enough.
It was produced under, we call it FAST, so that will seem like a long time during the process.
All right. The thing I want to talk about today or ask questions about is more about Goldman's risk management and put its trading in context of your risk management policies. And ultimately explore why the story that's told there seems to be different than the public perception about what's going on. And maybe we can clear some of that up. And the period I want to focus on mortgage related, and I want to focus on the period 2006, late 2006 till late 2008. David, could you start by giving me the general financial picture of Goldman Sachs in terms of balance sheet and where the mortgage-related business fits in. I know at the end of December 2007 you had about $1 trillion worth of assets,
I think a majority
of that was not mortgage-related.
That's correct.
Could you sort of take me through how big it is, how it fits
sure.
in
well, let,
your
let
business?
Me, let me do it a way that I actually know without going back and I'd have to look to answer the question you asked about assets.
I don't need exact numbers.
Mortgages, historically, we think of our FIC business. We have one word that is FIC, fixed income currencies and commodities, has five main businesses, there's many sub-businesses. It has currencies, commodities, credit, interest rates, and mortgages. So those are the five main businesses in FIC. Mortgages has been by far the smallest of those five businesses. So while it's an important business at Goldman Sachs, it is far and away the smallest of our FIC businesses. And so, again, we've published some of these numbers. Even if you look in 2007, which I believe at the time was a record year for mortgages, mortgages were less than 5% of revenues.
As we put on here,
yeah, right.
You can say these are all these
just
from looking.
Again, it's less than 5% of the five. It's an important business, but by far the smallest of our FIC businesses.
Mm-hmm. And in the mortgage business, tell me if I come down from Goldman Sachs to FIC and five businesses, and I'm in the mortgage business. Underneath the mortgage business, what's there? I understand there's like various trading desks, but how does
you're gonna,
generally?
You're surpassing my level of knowledge.
That's all right. Can you tell me who would know that?
Dan Sparks.
You're also talking to some people that are on those desks as well, who would know that as well. But Dan probably could give you the best. Yeah.
All right. And in terms of, I understand you have longs, you have shorts, you have assets. Would the assets of the mortgage business all be in one place, where a long would be an asset, or a short is netted out against that, so that you have a net amount of assets, or is it hit both sides of the balance sheet and then you net it?
Well, again, I just want to make sure where I answer the question you're asking, because it could be a different answer for the balance sheet and for risk. So mm-hmm. you could have a situation where both the long and the short appear on the balance sheet, but from a risk report, I might see it might net zero.
Got it.
So, you know, it depends. And I would be much, from my point of view, although we focus on balance sheet limits and we look at that, because, you know, if you have two things that are on the balance sheet, therefore they're not exactly the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not perfectly hedged. So there is, if you have a dollar of something that largely offsets, it's less risky than if you have $1 trillion of the same things. Back to what I said before, that, you know, even something that's never happened before could happen. So we'll pay attention to balance sheet, but we'll pay even more attention to risk reports.
Right. Would you say, tell me about how much time the mortgage department and the management of its risk took in the period running up to late 2006, as compared with the rest of your business? Did it take a disproportionate amount of your time?
Well, I'll do something that I know they tell me never to do. I'll answer the question, and I'll answer the question you didn't ask.
Okay.
Leading up to that period, it took a little, and during that period, it took a lot.
I suspected that was the answer.
I didn't think I would surprise you with that answer, so I thought it was okay for me to do that.
And
again, it took a little because it was small. It wasn't that volatile. You know, the mortgage markets had not been terribly volatile. And so, therefore, it took a proportionate amount of my time. And because it was the smallest business, it was proportional.
Right. Okay. And after, in late 2006, that started to change.
Yeah.
You want to talk a little bit how that changed and how your risk management systems cope with that?
Sure. I'll spend 30 seconds, if you want, on the now famous or infamous meeting that I didn't think was so much earth-shattering at the time, but I guess...
It still got a lot of press, hasn't it?
Sure got a lot of press, a lot more press than, you know, because I actually just thought I was doing what I'm supposed to do in my job. And it was, you know, very simply, we had, you know, as you've heard me say, I do look at the P&L of all of our businesses every day. It's a very good early warning sign. It's, you know, a very simple risk management tool, but it's actually a very good risk management tool. And, you know, you look for patterns. One of the reasons I look for patterns is not to criticize desks if they lose money, but to understand what's going on. And sometimes what I worry about as a risk manager is that people may have had a point of view that might have been a very sensible point of view, but if you're really close to it, you might get wedded to it. And so maybe the world has changed, if something's going on that should cause you to at least question the point of view. Why do you have it? Is it still valid? Has it changed? Maybe it is still valid. Maybe it's fine, but at least someone outside of the people who actually had the point of view questioning it. So I look and I see that mortgages, which usually, as we said, is not on the radar screen, had, you know, a series of losing days, not that usual. And of course, you know, we have to remember that even in late 2006, there was lots of talk about issues in the subprime mortgage market. It was already starting to be pretty public that the subprime mortgage market was declining. We're seeing some issues. I'm looking at P&L. And so I basically called the guys on the desk and I said, let's sit down and talk about this. Let's talk about what your positions are. And so we had a big meeting with several people from the mortgage desk, some people in controllers, some people in market risk, some people in credit risk, which is the way we do things. Everybody gets together and talks about things. and they went through a lot of their positions in a lot of different places, including what they had long, what they had short, where we had credit lines out to other people, so all different types of things. And then what were they seeing in the market? We had controllers there as well, because one of the things I mentioned, I think one of the most important risk management things is fair value accounting, and so we wanted to make sure that we're all comfortable. Besides what risk, were we marking things appropriately? Should things be marked down? Should things be marked up? We wanted to make sure everybody was on the same page. Coming into that meeting, basically, and again, very well publicized, my instructions to the mortgage desk were, we should get closer to home.
Before we pursue the meeting and what happened afterwards, I'd like to, if you would, put Goldman Sachs' risk management system in context, maybe vis-a-vis other financial institutions. And I think maybe because there's no great best practices, it may have to do with, you tell me if I'm right or wrong on this, that every institution is different and everyone has a different business model, so everyone needs a different risk management model.
Yes.
And as new products come in over time, that has to develop or you're going to miss something.
Correct.
And tell me how Goldman is. It's more a trader. It's than a conventional investment bank that's underwriting. I mean, it does that, but a huge part of your business is trading. Isn't that right?
I'm not sure. I don't actually believe that we were any more of a trading firm than any of our competitors.
A lot of them were trading firms too.
Right.
Yeah.
We certainly were more of a trading firm than we were in the 1980s, for example.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But that's because the world changed.
Yep. And so, what impact does that have on risk management? How do you? Is getting closer to zero a good place to be, or is that something a good trader should try to be all the time, or how does that?
No, it's not something a good trader should try to be all the time. But it because as we got through the period end of 2006 to 2007, there was so much uncertainty in that market. In the mortgage market,
mm-hmm.
Our view was that it made the most sense to be as close to home as possible. There are times when we have views on things, and there are times when the market is so uncertain that there's the risk of losing money is so much greater than the chance of making money that you say, okay, you know what, we'll miss it. If we were wrong, I'm sorry to jump around a little bit, but we also have a point of view here that it's much easier to to buy things when they're going up than to sell things when they're going down. So if you think maybe it's going to go up, maybe it's going to go down, be close to home. If you're wrong and it goes up, you missed part of the opportunity. You have plenty of opportunities to make money. Get in. But let's avoid the opportunity to really lose a lot of money.
Okay.
You know, you use the term closer to home. Can you just explain what that means?
Well, closer to home basically means be as close to neutral to the market as you can be. No, they can never be at zero. We know that.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, just the fact that they're not going to have zero inventory, so there'll be long some things, there'll be short some things, they'll try to get them to offset, but they move at different speeds. And so in some cases, you don't even know if you're long or short. You try to be as close to neutral as possible.
Because being long or short creates risk in volatile markets.
Correct.
Okay. Correct. And so, okay. So, I know somebody has characterized one of your emails as saying that the meeting of December 13th generated a decision to go short so you could take advantage of attractive opportunities.
No,
is that a fair characterization?
No. It said that we should get closer to home so that we could take advantage of attractive opportunities if they arose.
Okay. And vis-a-vis some of the other financial institutions, would you say you were farther away from home or closer from the start?
I don't know.
Okay.
I should say, with hindsight,
yes.
My guess is we were closer. But we certainly didn't know at the time. Yeah. And I only know that from what we saw afterwards,
yes,
about how much people had accumulated on their balance sheet. We didn't have any work close to that.
Yeah. What would have been your, more or less, your total long position in mortgages about that time?
I don't know. I don't really know.
Wouldn't have been 5% of your total asset.
I don't think 5% of our total assets. We had $1 trillion.
That'd be $50 billion.
$50 billion? No.
Total. You're saying total long versus your shorts. You're saying your net long $50 billion.
No. Total long. Could the mortgage balance sheet have been $50 billion?
I have a
mortgage
balance
sheet. Mortgage balance sheet.
Look in there.
Mortgage balance sheet could have been $50 billion.
Yeah, no. I agree with that.
Well, why should the paper we talk about?
I don't remember, but now
your long would have been 50, but there would have been some.
Oh yeah,
sure. The net. I'm talking.
Oh, the net. Oh, sure. No, the net was wasn't even close.
Right.
Net wasn't even close.
That's what I'm saying.
I think this document, which is very hard to read, I'm afraid to say, sort of was something you were provided with before that meeting. It doesn't show anywhere near $50 billion worth
of net.
No.
That wouldn't they? Right. No, net would have been much, much smaller.
Yeah.
But gross could have been bigger.
Okay. Do you have someplace some written risk protocols? You testified, I think, at the Levin Committee in your prepared testimony that, you know, you're within your risk protocols in mortgages.
We have a whole series of risk limits. We have limits for desks in a whole variety of ways. So we will have, just balance sheet limits. That's mm-hmm. an easy one. They'll have borrow limits.
Mm-hmm.
We have, back to our credit spread widening that I was talking about, we give all of our desks have credit spread widening limits as well. So that's at least three limits that various desks would have.
Would it be possible for us to get a history of how those limits may have changed during the course of 2006 to 2008?
Sure.
All right.
Actually, you used the term risk protocols in your testimony, and I was wondering if that would be a list then of the different elements that you'd be looking at.
We can do that. We can get you all that.
That would be quite helpful. Thank you.
Sure. Sure.
Now, I'll just tell you, again, in advance, what one of the things you'll see is that the mortgage desk in 2007 was frequently over some of its risk limits. And we spent a lot of time in 2007 trying to get it back down to its risk limits.
I understand that that's part of your risk management system, that you have limits, and it's sort of a red flag.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
And you might have seen in some of the emails that there were then temporary risk limits that were put on for a particular period of time.
You have the right idea. Yeah. It's meant to call to people's attention so
correct.
They can go look at it and decide if it's a good
limit
or bad.
People sometimes say to me, are your limits, hard absolute limits? And the answer is, first of all, I don't think it's possible to do that. What happens if somebody what does it mean to the but limits are there for a reason. Limits are there to cause discussion if you get too close to or over the limit, and then some more senior people get to decide, do you want to give them a temporary increase in limit, do you want to give them a permanent increase in limit, or do you want to say no, get down to your limit?
And how often would you do that? Daily? Or hourly, or weekly, monthly?
Well, it was 2007 was an unusual time.
Mm-hmm.
Limits are not there so that people are over them all the time. People are supposed to stay within their limit. 2007 was a time where the mortgage market in particular was so volatile that, because remember, a lot of things, and we'll talk about the VAR, because the one we're most focused on at the time, a lot of things go into that limit. It's driven by position size. It's also driven by volatility.
Right.
And so in 2007, when we were literally reducing the size of the position, volatility was going up so fast that they couldn't reduce the size of the position fast enough to stay under their limit. So it was, I can't remember if it was an hourly conversation or a daily conversation, but it was a frequent conversation.
Very frequent.
It's a frequent conversation.
Okay.
And you're going to meet Craig. You're going to meet with Craig Broderick later this week. Mm-hmm. Schedule. Yeah. He's the chief risk officer, right, reporting to David, and he can give you chapter and verse on all the,
okay,
the
great
struggles. I guess that's the right word.
Now, you had the famous December meeting, and some orders were sort of issued as a result of that. At least according to this email I have from Mr. Sparks.
I would say some conclusions were reached.
Okay, okay, good.
Some conclusions as to what we should do.
I think the impression in the press, and maybe other parts in the public's impression, is that as a result of that meeting, you guys decided to go short, and you made a killing in 2007. Is that a fair impression?
It's fair that's the impression. It's not at all happening.
Right. That's what I'm trying to.
No. And look, we've given the numbers. I mean, the numbers are pretty clear. In the residential mortgage business, total in 2007, our revenues were less than $500 million. In a year, then we have $45 billion of revenues. So that's not a killing in a market that was incredibly volatile. I actually think it was a pretty good attempt to get close to home. Mm-hmm. If you could keep revenues plus or minus to 500. If you had said to me on the first day of the year, if you had said to me, here's what's going to happen in the market, it's going to be wild like it was, and you could have plus or minus $500 million of revenues in the residential mortgage business, I would have signed on the dotted line. I would have said that would have been terrific.
Yes. Sure.
Does that include any payoffs from CDS contracts?
Yes.
All those assets.
That's
a total
residential mortgage business. Total
underwriting fees.
Total.
That's it.
Yes, that's it. Residential mortgage $500 million.
Can I say one thing? Because I think you're going back to the seminal article. Remember, the seminal article is only referring to one side. All it's saying is you made billions of dollars supposedly on shorts. But it didn't take into account the billions of dollars we lost on the lawns.
Right. Do you agree with that?
Yes. I mean, again, you heard me say this. So,
yeah.
I mean, we would not, there was, we didn't know what was going to happen. And I know there's a common belief that we knew the market was going to go down and therefore we had this big short on. I wish I was that smart. We didn't know what was going to happen. I mean, I'm not proud of this, but look at the firm's results in 2008. They weren't great. If we really knew what was going to happen, we would have done something differently. We still were profitable in 2008, but not in the mortgage business. We weren't profitable in 2008. And our view was it felt bad, but we didn't know. Again, remember back to 2000. It's hard to remember back. There were a couple of times in 2007 where things started to snap back. And you had to worry about snapback risk. And you just didn't know where things were going. I believe it was, again, I'm doing this from memory, I'm not going to go into the segment of the markets, right after the summer of 2007, all credit assets actually rallied a lot. I think it was September 2007, big rally in credit assets. And everyone felt like the world was great again. So should everyone have gone long? I mean, nobody really knew. There was a lot of volatility, and it was mainly focused in subprime mortgages, but it was focused in other credit assets as well. And so from a risk management point of view, our view in that business was get as close to home as we could. And I think what really differentiated us in 2007 was not that we had this big short and we were killing, it's that we didn't have a big net long and we didn't get killed on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And we basically did. And if you look through, because all these emails have been presented to me with hindsight,
mm-hmm.
But it's a constant theme of trying to reduce risk. Sure, you might have a person saying, oh, we should be really short, and then you see it getting reduced, and then you see someone else saying, oh, now it's time to go long, and then you see it being reduced. It's a constant theme of uncertainty and saying, risk of being long, risk of being short, get closer to home. Okay. Now, all that being said, we did have a bias to being on the short side. So in getting close to home, when you know you can't be at zero, the view was it felt like it was declining. And again, this wasn't a secret. I mean, the subprime mortgage market was declining pretty rapidly in 2008. And so if you have to err being short rather than being long, but don't be very anything. Don't be very short. Don't be very long. Don't be very anything, but err towards being short.
It wasn't a long short or a long long, or big right. short or right. big
it
long.
It's not a big anything.
Yeah, I right. think we've given it to you, which you might find helpful. If you look at the ABX index for the subprime throughout that period, what you'll note is it sort of went down January, February, going down. And then there was a big spike up, for which lasted for, I don't know, 2 months or so. If you look at the earnings reports of various firms during that period, we were underperforming in mortgages because we were trying to be close to home. Other people obviously were doing something different. Mm-hmm. They were doing very well. And then in June or whenever, then the world seemed to end, meaning that there's suddenly a collapse. But, you know, I don't know how anybody could have predicted that. Mm-hmm. But it just went from, but if you look at the year, and I think there's a graph you would have seen and stuff that you produced. I should show you all that.
That the goal through the entire year was reduce risk.
Okay. I think some of the confusion among people who have seen your emails and things like that may come from the fact that sometimes people use the term big short.
Yes, including me.
Including you and I and Mr. Torre?
Yes.
Fabrice, yes.
Yeah. But again, there's an email. I know these emails by heart now. That on a specific day where we actually had a profit, where there's an email from me to our president Gary Cohn that says shows what happened to people. Can you imagine what something like? Can you imagine what happened to people who didn't have the big short? But if you look down, what you'll see is we had something like I don't know the exact numbers. $300 million of revenue on the short and $200 million of losses on the long. And so one of the awful things about email, people use it like you talk, and you don't necessarily write out the entire paragraph you're thinking. If you, again, you go back to that time when I wrote that email, it was shortly after, I believe, the end of the third quarter when a lot of firms had disclosed what their exposures were, and they all had very, very big exposures, long exposures to mortgages. And my answer was, shows what happened to the people who didn't have that big short that we had to offset that big long.
Right. You're talking net.
Talking net, yeah. Exactly. Exactly.
You know, you were talking gross on the short side.
Right, yeah. Gross, but when you look down, you see clearly that I'm referring to that offset the long.
Yeah, your email does reflect that, I agree.
But I didn't, I mean, I stopped after the first sentence, and you know, if I could go back and write the whole rest of the paragraph that was in my mind, I would have.
But you have a right. If we seem to have seen sort of defensive in the last half year, and we put out, in some occasions, and that's why we put out the white paper, is because that seminal newspaper article, you know, obviously quotes all sorts of people who are traders who were, you know, in hindsight, they're talking their book.
Had an expert, right?
Number one. And number two, it's like when you're self-reviews at the end of the year. I can assure you, once you've seen what happened during the year, you can certainly pick out all the things you thought at the beginning of the year to achieve all these great ends. But from the firm's perspective and from David's perspective, we just wanted to be near zero. Some guy over here is very short. It's only because you can have something wrong over here and we don't really care. Right.
And I would never know. I mean, I wouldn't know that X trader had the short and Y trader had the long or S. Because to me, it doesn't matter.
Right.
I would talk to the head of the desk and I'd say, here's where I think you should be overall. And we were talking constantly during that year.
Right.
And how it was executed, it didn't matter.
Right. So the conclusions that came out of the December 13 meeting was to go from a small net long to get closer to zero. How long did those conclusions stay as the conclusions of Goldman Sachs? All of 2007, or did they change pretty soon?
It's hard to understand how Goldman Sachs works without being there. We're a firm that thrives on communication. So we talk all the time. So it's not like, you know, this is out there, no more conversation, you know, I'll call you back when we're done. This constant dialogue throughout, however, I mean, so it's not like I can say, you know, this message stands until I call you back or anything like that. But again, if you look throughout 2007, the goal throughout the year was a constant theme of trying to get closer to home. And it wasn't that these stood. We had constant conversations about, and again, back to what I said, we just didn't know. And Greg said the APX was down, and then it was up, and then it was down again. It was so much uncertainty. We wanted to constantly try to get closer to home, but again, from the short side. Rather be a little bit short than a little bit long, but don't want to be a lot of anything through the whole year.
There's a document you may want to focus on. We did two board presentations during the year, which you have, okay? And in it, there's this, I'm going to call it not a balance sheet really, but it's a snapshot of what we look like in mortgages. And there's a snapshot, and I don't remember if it was March or something, and a snapshot is pretend in July. And although it's August or whatever, and although somewhat it's apples and oranges, because as you know, this whole thing about hedging, you're hedging apples with oranges, and then suddenly nobody likes oranges anymore, and your hedge didn't quite work. So you never, that's why David would say, you never quite know where you are. That's why we keep saying, you know, we were probably net short during the course of the year. Why? Because over the course of the year, we made what we call a little bit of money, because it is that we think actually a lot less than $500 million. But that was the number through controllers and everyone.
It's the whole business. Right?
They would say fine. But all I was going to say, when you look at that report, which you'll discover if you look at it, yeah, there's all these long things and then there's these short things. But they basically are right around, you know, flat, close to home, however you want to describe it. And then so you should look at those two snapshots because they were prepared contemporaneously, for want of a better word, presented to the, you know, board as part of what's going on in this world. And I think they're quite useful just to look at. I don't know if you have, but
if you don't have those handy, would you let me know and I'll just
I'd love to see them.
Okay.
Fine. We can give you the, you know, exact pages and show you what they are, because
that'd be great. I appreciate that. Is it? But when you're closer to home, there's a pile of longs and there's a pile of shorts to get you closer to home. Is it possible that there seems to be some confusion that when you make money on one side, that's how you make billions. Is that a fair characterization of what happened?
Well, but you only have that side where you made the billions because you have that, and I said we, because we had that other side. So we would never have, again, in that environment with the uncertainty that we had, we would never have allowed them to have the short position that made the billions if we didn't have the long positions that was losing the billions.
Right.
That's why we had it. And again, if you look through it, you'll see constant emails and conversations about reducing both sides because they weren't perfectly hedged. And we knew that. And you'll see conversations about risks of snap back on one thing, because again, if you're short one thing and long the other thing, there's always a risk that the thing you're short will go up and the thing that you're long, you know, won't go down, or will go down. So one side can go down, one side can go up, because they're different parts of the capital structure. They're riskier. So we didn't like that. So we were trying to reduce both sides through the entire thing and really get closer to home. But the thing you have to remember is we're still in a client business.
Right.
So while we're doing that, our clients, and I know there's all this talk about all this stuff that we sold to our clients, but a lot of stuff our clients sold to us too. And we were buying some of that stuff in because they wanted to sell it. We wanted to provide liquidity. We wanted to make a price. And so when you bought some stuff in, then you had to do something on the other side to offset it as you were trying to sell things. So it's not you remember, you're not starting with a static pool. It's not like you start on day one with this and say, okay, over the course of the year, just chip away. There's other things happening through the course of the whole year.
You're making a market.
Correct.
Okay. When you do that, when you buy a mortgage asset from one of your clients, and then you turn around and sell it to another client because you're trying to bring the asset side down, there's a profit or a loss, right? And that's reflected in your revenues?
The short answer is yes.
What's the long answer?
The long answer is it depends. Nothing is as simple as it seems. So you buy an asset from your client, and if you buy it and sell it 2 minutes later, then it's simple. Whatever you buy,
right.
It, but what's more likely is you buy it, and then you don't know when you're sell it, so you hedge it with something else.
Okay.
And so then a week later, or a day later, or 3 days later, you sell it. and maybe you've made money or you've lost money on the sale, but maybe you've made money or you've lost money on the hedge. And so it's not as simple as just bought and sold.
Okay, that's helpful.
Plus, for us, just so you know, I guess the other important thing is, it's not like we buy it for 10, and then if we sell it for 8, we've lost 2. We buy it for 10. The next day, if the market's going down, and it's worth 9, we mark it to 9. We lose it. So it's generally, when we sell things to people, it should be revenue neutral when on the sale. Now, we tend to be a little bit more on the conservative side of the mark, or the money moving, but the idea is to mark things to a level so a trader should be indifferent between selling or holding.
Okay. But when the asset comes in, the hedge gets put on, the sale takes place, the hedge gets taken off, in the end, the net of that shows up in revenue.
In the end, there's a net that shows up in revenue.
Right. So if you'd made a killing in mortgage assets in 2007, it would have been reflected in a much higher number than $500 million.
Certainly would have.
Thank you.
That's correct.
Gary, you want to?
Yeah, I have a big picture question for you. Did you, not specifically with respect to Goldman, but when the iBank started to go public, did you perceive any change in attitudes towards risk, towards leverage, all of the rest of the behaviors which you alluded to earlier?
You know, you're going way back. I mean, we went public in 1999, and I think the last one that had gone public was Morgan Stanley.
In the late 80s?
10 years before that. The world was such a different place then. I mean, the capital markets were so much smaller. They really weren't global. So it was just such a different place back then. So, and I was in such a different place back then. You know, in the 80s, I wouldn't have any idea what the other firms were really doing.
No, you're okay.
I think we're fine.
We're okay.
Okay.
We just gave it a change.
Oh,
okay.
So, please throw me a bottle of water. Oh, it'll be all right.
Is anybody else
on?
And with respect to both Goldman and other firms, because I think you guys are probably among the better of risk management firms, as far as I can tell. Do you think that compensation structures globally in the financial services industries encourage the kind of leverage and risk tolerance that exacerbated the situation when these black swan events occurred?
I'm much better at talking about us than others. And I am, I'm not getting yelled at for going down this path, but I believe very strongly
about
that.
I think he's talking about me.
You know. That you can't have a compensation structure that will cause you to have good risk management. You have to have a risk management structure that will cause you to have good risk management. You can have a compensation structure that could negatively affect your risk management. But I think it's very hard to make it positive. It's very hard for your compensation to cause you to have good risk management. You need to have good risk management.
Since I assume, if you want me to interrupt, I won't, but I was just going to say a couple different things. I just know it's true around here. You know, we've never done things, for example, which may be done elsewhere, to give a trader a fixed percentage of his book, or her book, because at the end of the year, when you see what the results are, you know, the fact is, in our mortgage market, our mortgage department, obviously we didn't make that much money, but we didn't lose a lot of money, so everyone was really delighted with the performance. I thought it was outstanding for that reason, okay, just looking on the risk and so on. And as you find, when you look through the financial services industry, you'll find, you know, all sorts of things like multi-year guaranteed contracts, which we don't do, and a bunch of other things, which we can't talk about the firm really exacerbates, but because of the way we compensate people there, and David can talk about, you know, how we think of it, how we go about it, and how we look at it, we do a holistic look at to see, well, you know, it's this thing we used to figure out at partners meetings back in the 90s. I remember this discussion. Are you making rain or standing? Okay. If you're in a rising market, that just happens to be the market you're trading in.
Goldman Sachs, I have a lot of sayings.
You have sayings, but you know, you just make money. Does that person really
than anything greater. Now you have to figure all that out. What are their other characteristics? How do they contribute to the organization? If you don't do all those things, then you do have a problem. And, you know, I can say when you read in the newspaper, you could get an impression there might be places where they might do things, you know, slightly differently, but who knows? It's really hard to tell.
Can I generalize that issue? I mean, we've read all the promising practices about risk management, but you guys did it. How do you balance the trader's desire to maximize their own self-interest against the trader's sensitivity to the interest of the larger company? How do you do that, both in terms of compensation structure and in terms of relationships?
So a couple of things, and again, we're in big theory here, so I'm going to give you as best I can. First of all, traders have a series of limits. So regardless of what they might want to do, they have to operate within their limits. If someone kind of repeatedly operates outside their limits, they'll be operating somewhere else. They won't be operating here. Second of all, every person at Goldman Sachs has what, and you probably read about this too, has what we call 360-degree review. People are reviewed by people junior to them, their peers, and people senior to them, people within their business units, people outside their business units. We take those reviews very seriously, and it has all kinds of things in it, including not just commercial productivity, but what we call leadership, culture, values, cooperate, you know, how you work with other people. All that's taken into account in compensation. So if a trader was, let's just say, very commercial, but the controllers people felt this person was very uncooperative with them the entire year, I would probably know about that, and that would affect their compensation. Now, it's subjective. It's not objective. But we take all of those things into consideration. Greg said nobody gets a share of their revenues. Nobody has a formulaic compensation. So, you know, if somebody goes from 100 to 200, they don't get 10% of that. They might do better, but they might not do better, depending on how they did it and how they worked with other people. So it's all taken into consideration when we look at people's compensation.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt if you had more questions. As I understand it from your description of what you call the controller's function, you have a parallel organization, at least that's the way it was described to me. Excuse me, that parallel to each of the business units, you will have people in the risk management function that understand what's going on. Can you describe a bit how that works and how you give your risk managers the stature and authority you were talking about?
Sure. I'm going to say it's simple, but I guess it must not be simple. But it's, again, I've never been anywhere other than Goldman Sachs, so I only know the way we do it. Basically, it's known here that, I'll give you a couple of examples. If, let's take some of these positions we thought that might be harder to mark. So let's just say a trader thinks it's worth 10. And the controllers look at it, they verify it, they do their info, and say, no, we think it's worth 8. And actually, that doesn't usually, it's the other way around. Usually the traders are more conservative. But let's just say you have a crisis and you think a trader's not marking it appropriately, so they say 10, control says, no, it's 8. We'll say to the trader, great, you think it's worth 10? Go sell it for 10. Then we'll know it's worth 10. If you can't, by definition, controller says 8, it's 8. That's the answer. You give them the stature by saying, they're right. That's the answer. If a trader has if there's a credit limit, and a trader has a good trade that they want to do, and they say, okay, I'd like to do this trade, but it will put us over our limit. They go to the people in the credit department, they say, we want to do this, and, you know, it's not an us versus them environment. It's very cooperative, we'll work together, we'll try to find a way, but in the end, if the credit people say, too much risk, can't do it, the answer is no. The only alternative the trader has is they can appeal. They can, you know, go up the chain, not in the trading side, but go up the chain, you know, they can go to Craig Broderick, who you'll meet, and go to me. the chances that I would actually overrule the person who made that decision, they have a much better chance with the first person they talk to than when they go up the chain. The chances go down as you go up the chain because you know, people are not tend to overrule. But that authority is absolute. No trader can move money. No trader can move capital. No trader can, you know, arbitrarily increase or decrease firm-wide limits. And it's part of the environment here. It's part of the culture, and it's the rules. It's the way we operate here.
It has a virtuous circle element, meaning that you can get really talented, good people to go into the roles because they're treated with respect, and it's just crystal clear. You know, David is the CFO. He has the federation, and we call ourselves the federation.
Couldn't even tell you where it came from. We tried to figure out what should we call everybody on the whole risk management side, and the back office definitely didn't work, support. If you read things and you see the word federation, that's what it means. Because you might come across it, because it's a term that's used frequently here.
What's Main Street mean?
We have a company called Main Street Mortgage. It's a
mortgage
company.
The only point being, you're going to meet, because we're going to, I talked to your colleague, you'll meet Brian Lee, who's going to be going through how the controllers operates and what they're doing and so on and so forth. And I talked to your colleague last night about that. Arranged for that. But I think pounds for pound, what happens is, we tend to get better people. They stay here, they're happier because, look, I've never worked at another firm either. I used to be a part of a law firm, but, you know, one of the questions you have when you come here would be, okay, I'm on the support side of the firm, what's that like, okay? And I can assure you, as you probably know yourselves, because maybe all of you are lawyers, I haven't thought about that, so maybe I don't mean when you're an economist, I don't know, but in any event, you don't want to work somewhere where, you know, they treat you poorly, okay, even though it has lots of elements that might be fun or interesting. And so that when you go up through the firm here, people treat you with respect, and then you tend to get better people, and they're going to treat you with more respect, meaning because it's equal, as you'll discover, whether it's Craig Broderick or any other people I think you'll meet, the traders will, you know, find them to be people who they can talk to, understand what they're doing, and have some really good judgment on it. And everything David would say would be, remember the 8-10 example? If the trader has some insightful point which they've never brought up, and then they bring it up, so it looks like it's actually worth 8.5, it's not that controllers won't then say, oh, maybe you're right in some of those cases. Sure. But whenever they don't say you're right, then it's always going to be the controller, and everybody knows that.
It's a very cooperative relationship. So, again, I don't want you to think that this is, you know, a bunch of people standing here saying, no, you can't do this. It will work as a partnership. But in the end, the final decision rests with the risk managers.
There's a whole concept, and you see it particularly with regulators and companies, of information asymmetries. And one can imagine, particularly with a bespoke deal, that the trader will know what's going on, and the controller really won't, however skilled they may be at controlling. How do you deal with that set of problems?
We generally, first of all, everything, we have booking systems, we have model, we have all kinds of price verification and model verification and different types of systems to make sure that the information is passed on. If something is too complicated for the control side of the firm to actually understand it, we wouldn't let them do it. We wouldn't let it be done. We'd stop it. Now, again, I can't tell you, we're a very big organization with thousands and thousands of trades. I can't tell you the mistakes aren't made. They are. That something doesn't get done that in the end proves to be more complicated than we thought it was. So those things definitely happen around Goldman Sachs. But ultimately, if we couldn't understand it, we wouldn't want to do it. If we knew up front.
At some point, I'd appreciate if we might talk to one of your personnel people about how performance is judged for traders. Excuse me, in some of the incentive structures.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Sure. Mm-hmm.
That would be great.
Do you want to do that?
Sorry.
We're going to arrange for more days. I know based on your schedule, you guys seem to be quite full. Or would you be? We're perfectly. We don't stay right now. When we're done with the thing, we can think about the schedules and do whatever. Because I know today you have.
Well, I can also speak of ignorance. I mean, should you really be talking to personnel, or should you be talking to Dan Sparks about how we'll get the right people.
I was thinking the career path. Somebody on the controller side. How do you advance? Do you skip over to the trader side and come back again?
The answer is sometimes. You'll find actually. And I was going to say more than other places, but I have no idea where other places are. So you'll actually see a lot of something called cross-pollinization. You'll find people from the control side move to the trading side. You'll find people from the trading side move to the control side. And if you look at the control side, I was investment banker, our treasurer was an investment banker, our head of market risk was a derivatives trader. So people move back and forth, and you'll find the same thing on the trading side. You'll find a bunch of people from controllers and risk management. People do move back and forth, and we can only do that because of what Greg said before, because of the respect people are treated with and the fact that they view their career as being equally good in either side of the business.
Yeah, I was going to get to the point, because you already mentioned the derivatives person on the heading the risk side, is I don't think a lot of the firms, people move from being a partner or whatever in the producing side to decide, oh, I'm going to go over to this other side to head a unit, head risk or do anything else. Where in here, it's a very respected job. And the person will go ahead and do it. And so it's works out. Anyway, sorry, I could tell you're trying to.
No.
Sorry, I want to get back to the derivative.
No.
I only have a couple of more things I want to explore. Do you look at risk from the side of how long an asset may have been on your balance sheet?
That is a risk factor.
And
we have reports. They're seeing Brian.
Well, I'm Brian. They'll see Brian.
We have one metric called H items. So we will look at different assets, different businesses should have assets for different points of time. So our merchant bank, for example, should have assets for a long time. That's what they do. But our foreign exchange trading desk should not. And so we have what we call aged asset limits. And so we have different buckets. And Brian can do this more exactly. I think we have a 0 to 90, 90 to 180, 180 to 270, 270 to 360, and over 360 days. And every desk will have how much can they have in certain buckets. So we'll give them limits of where they can keep things for longer periods of time, and that's okay. And if they go over that limit, we have meetings. We go through why you're over your limit, what do you have? At the general point of view, if you have more than you should in a certain bucket, you couldn't sell it. Why haven't you been able to sell it? Is it more correctly? If it's not more correct, because we marked it down to where it should be, then you'd go sell it. So, yes, we look at the AM. That was a long answer to.
No,
I could have just said yes. It's a risk factor, but we look at that very carefully at how long assets are on the books.
And does it come a point at some point where you just say sell it?
There could.
Yeah.
There could.
When you do an RMBS transaction and you take a piece, that then becomes an asset on the books. Is the whole CDO thing a way of liquidating that sometime? Is that how that business derived or evolved? Or?
No, not necessarily. Again, I'm not the world expert in how the business derived, but it could be a reason you put the asset in the books in the first place.
So
that you can accumulate assets to ultimately put them into a CDO or a CLO or other types of transactions and sell them into the market. And that was really the common way they were done. Say, okay, we're going to, investors wanted. They wanted risk. We wanted exposure to certain risk categories. How do you do so? Okay, we want to do $1 billion CDO of certain assets. Yeah. We don't go out and buy the billion. You accumulate them over time.
Yeah.
Then you pool them together and you issue a CDO.
It's an in-house warehouse.
It's an in-house warehouse. Exactly right. And of course, there's risk in doing that.
Yep.
Which everybody found out about. If you didn't think there was risk, there was a lot of risk because. You can accumulate them based on where you think you're going to sell the CDO, and then if you can't sell the CDO, all of a sudden you were wrong, and you have those assets.
And as part of managing this risk, does it come a time when you just tell the trader, sell it at whatever price, or is it, do you have a lot of CDOs or RMBS transactions, assets on your books from 2005, for instance?
Do we now? I have no idea. Yeah. I don't know.
In the normal course of business, you wouldn't think you would. But I don't know.
I wouldn't think we would, but I don't think you
would. Who would I talk to about that? Mr. Sparks?
I think Dan might be.
He would not have now.
Oh, your question is currently.
Well, no, it's... I'm trying to understand the business.
He would be able to...
He would be able to tell you normally how it would work. He would be able to tell
And if it was sitting there too long, somebody would talk to him about they was exceeding... and then
he'll tell you about how it goes at a certain point from the origination desk to the trading desk, and then the traders trade
To manage it. The trading desk would manage it as opposed to an origination
desk. If he doesn't know the answer, we'll find something.
We'll figure it out.
All right.
Again, you're also talking to some traders that are still here, so you could also have them address them.
So you may have assets that you sold during 2007 to somebody that they were up for sale. I mean, doesn't it become a function of price? Or
absolutely.
Yeah. And when you're in the market, you wanted to get rid of it, and somebody else wanted it
at a price.
Right.
At a price.
Right.
Even
if you're ultimately short, obviously, you sell something.
No matter what the quality of an asset is, there's generally somebody who wants it at a price. So there could be debt, claims on Lehman Brothers. Right? They're a bankrupt, and I'm not saying that, but they're a bankrupt company. Their claims trade because people think they'll get a recovery of some amount. They may get it, they may be right, they may be wrong. They might buy it at 30 cents a dollar, they might not buy it at 20 cents a dollar. So, there are assets that people buy at 2 cents on the dollar. They don't think it's a very good asset, but they think it's worth 3 cents or 4 cents. And so people buy things because they think at that price, it's a good value.
All right. And sometimes they're right, and sometimes they're wrong.
Yeah. That is definitely correct.
Yeah.
Can I ask?
Yeah.
Did Goldman ever have an aggregate counterparty exposure list somewhere where you knew that you were too exposed to Citi or too exposed to B of A or Morgan Stanley? Did you guys ever track that? We
keep track of our exposure to all of our counterparties.
Do you know if other firms did that? Do you have any idea?
I don't know. I would... My natural answer would have been
they must have, but before
2007, if you had asked me that question, I just would have said yes. I wouldn't have even caveated it. Today I'd say I don't know.
Remember what Jerry mentioned? One of the things Jerry mentioned we were down there, which is one of the things we think is really, really important and we think we can do, but I think he said only, we don't know, a few of them. It took the 20 major financial institutions in the world. Basically, you should be able to figure out your exposures. Example, if you read that company X is in trouble, the expectation is certainly, if you read that newspaper, you hope to have heard about it, but if it's new news, he reads about it. Dave's expectation is when he gets in the office, there's going to be five people telling him what our exposures are to that counterpart.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And what Jerry was sort of saying.
You should ask Craig about that one.
Yeah. But what Jerry was sort of saying is it's not entirely clear how many firms in the world can actually do that of the major financial institutions, because we're all quite global. We're fairly unified firms, you can sort of tell, because we're not lots of disparate businesses, really. I mean, it's pretty complicated, obviously, but it's not as though. But we would expect, because you can have an exposure, obviously, to some group sitting in your office in Singapore to some company that happens to be in California for whatever reason. The expectation should be you'd want to be able to know that immediately, and here we think we would know that.
Okay. We can get an aggregation of our exposure to any counterparty at a high level very quickly. To get all of the details and make sure you get the last dollar might take several hours, even a day, but the basic exposure we can get.
During the troubles, not the Irish troubles, our troubles, were you laying off exposure that you might have had to other major financial institutions that you suspected were in trouble?
You mean currently?
With the in 08, 07, 08, yeah.
Our exposures to financial institutions are uncollateralized exposures, mm-hmm. and I'll leave aside one piece, which I'm going to come back to in a second, tend not to be that big because, and I mentioned before you came in, all the financial institutions deal with each other so much that we tend to deal with each other largely on a zero margin trader. So we tend to collateralize everything back and forth. So our exposures generally aren't that big. The one place where we actually have reasonably big exposures to some other financial institutions is deposits. We literally have, we have a lot of cash at the end of the day, and we have to put it somewhere. And so, you know, one of the things we sometimes have to decide is, do we take a lot of risk to the biggest banks, or do who are the least likely to fail, or do we diversify our exposure to a lot of banks, but then some of them, you don't really know what's going to happen. We tend to be in the former camp, which is let's put most of our cash with the really biggest banks because too hard for the system to fail. And we're pretty confident Deutsche Bank's not going to fail.
I guess Buffett, what he did, he said treasuries.
Well, but we can't because literally we don't, so much cash flows in and out of Goldman Sachs every day that we don't know how much cash we're going to have at the end of the day. And we got $20 billion literally of cash at the end of the day. We have to put it somewhere, and the treasury market's closed. We can't, anytime anything we can do to reverse in treasuries, we do that too. We would always have dual cash possible. We're going to have a big pile of cash at the end of the day. We also have it in a lot of locations. So it's not just all in the U.S. We have it all over the world.
So far, we've talked to a lot of people who didn't have risk management systems like Goldman. And so I think this has actually been very instructive. You can learn from the people who failed and the people who didn't just as well, I think. And if there's other questions we have, can we come back to you on that?
Oh, of course. All
right. Cool. Yes.
More just kind of follow up, maybe it's via information request. You know, you said that, you know, part of the reason you held the meeting, the infamous meeting in December 6th, is that you saw P&L losses in the mortgage department. Could we get like a run from December 6th through the end of, say, 07 of the P&L of the mortgage department? Of that
sure.
report you saw, like some. It didn't have to be on a daily
basis.
Well,
I saw it was just like 10 days.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
It wasn't the whole year. That was a snapshot.
Right. Well, can we get that going forward through the end of those 7 months?
Sure, sure. Oh,
yeah. So monthly
P&L through the end of those 7. And then...
that may also be in the stuff that produced the blank fine communications. I think have all of those reports.
If you don't have to dig through it.
I bless you for that. Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
Easier, okay.
We don't have to go through ours.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's easier for us to dig through.
Okay. So December 1, 06.
Through the end of 07. And if we can get the same thing, the net mortgage exposure across the firm, if we can get that too.
Yeah, that is
harder? Really?
Well, it's a lot. It depends what you mean by
right.
net mortgage exposure.
So I guess just from the. So you, there was reference in the document to, you know, that you had the $50 billion gross, if you can get whatever.
Well, that's just balance sheet.
That's balance
sheet. Balance sheet's easy.
Okay.
But it's not good. But it won't. I mean,
what?
Happy to give it to you.
Right.
But it's not going to tell you very much.
Okay. Okay. And this is just a technical question, it may not be, but are your books mixed between trading and proprietary trading? You have a proprietary trading department. Who's, how does that kind of work?
Got all the way, almost all the way through the meeting. So I'll give you the easy answer.
Right.
And then I'll make it more complicated.
Okay.
So the easy answer is we have a very small business that is pure walled-off prop trading.
Okay.
Covered by the street, no customer interaction. They invest on behalf of Goldman Sachs. They trade on behalf of Goldman Sachs purely. That's easy.
Does that get reported as trading in mortgage-related assets?
It's not in mortgages.
It's separate.
It's an equity related. It's the old, it used to be equity arbitrage. It's now called GSPS, called the set of principal strategies. Small business. It's, you know, basically long short equities. I mean, it's the old, you know, Gus Levy started the business and Bob Rubin, and you know, basically it used to be you take merger arbitrage positions. So a company was, you know, you don't have business wise, and it morphed into other long short equity strategies. Walled off, totally separate. That's easy. Almost all of what we do is principal trading. So it's our money, because we buy and sell, where the risk starts on behalf of a customer, but it's on our books. And so again, I'll give you the simple, and you'll see how complicated it gets. Company wants to sell $5 billion of mortgages. Client wants to sell $5 billion of mortgages. We give them a price. We think about where do we think we can sell it, how long will it take us to sell it, and how are we going to hedge it in the interim. We walk in that day, we buy the $5 billion of mortgages. We're now long $5 billion of mortgages. Nobody at Goldman Sachs woke up and said, I want to be $5 billion, long $5 billion of mortgages. The customer said, I want to sell those. So we have that $5 billion of mortgages. We put a hedge on. Hedge is not a perfect hedge, but it's a hedge. Over the next week, we sell $2.5 billion of the mortgages. We unwind $2.5 billion of the hedges. But then someone else sells us something else, which kind of offsets it, like the hedge did, but not perfectly, so we'll put that on. Now we decide we have, you know, another client had wanted to buy $2.5 billion of mortgages, but not the same mortgages we had, so we sold them. We went short $2.5 billion of other mortgages, so now we unwind the hedge that we had, because we have this short from this other customer that offsets this $2.5 billion that's long. So now we say, oh, let's not sell this so quickly, because it's offsetting what we have. Now, could be a month later, we still have all this stuff there. Is that now a prop risk? Because we could have sold it, but we didn't sell it, because we had something else. And it all, and this example is, you know, I gave you two trades. We're doing thousands of trades every day, where we have to look at what offsets what risk are we left with, what do we want to sell, what don't want to sell, and is it okay to be a little long or a little short or a lot long or a lot short? But it all started with the customers. It didn't start because we said, let's put on a $5 billion long position. We might have said the other one. We said, okay, no, we have a $5 billion long. Let's either get a short or let's sell the long. But it all gets mixed up. And that's where I think it gets very hard, because someone said, well, you know, if you still have it 2 months later, it's a proposition, because you certainly could have sold it 2 months. And yes, we could have sold it in 2 months, but we might have had three other things that it was hedging, and so we didn't want to sell it over the 2 months. And so the prop, very small, that I can define for you. Right. Walled off, easy to define. Everything else is principal trading, and so we take risk, and we might have a view, which you can say, well, that's a prop view. It's a view, but it starts and ends with what we're doing for our customers.
So the GSPS, they weren't purchasing any mortgage-related assets?
No, I can't tell you they had zero.
Right.
But if they had any, it was teeny.
Right.
They were basically an equity long short business.
Okay. And then as far as, and they were not a part of the whole AIG, they weren't privy to any of.
No, totally walled off.
It's a separate.
Totally separate. It's literally walled off. Like there's a wall. You have to go through a separate door and you need a separate ID to get in, and it's walled off.
Okay.
I think in our initial responses that we provided in March, we identified the prop businesses that David's talking about and provided you with the activities. And that's actually something we wanted to talk, because that's a new request that's in your new subpoena, so we wanted
to talk
about
that.
Well, then, you know, other firms had, you know, proprietary trading desks who famously got blown up for purchases, so we weren't sure why.
We wanted to talk to you guys about that specific request and get you what you need.
Let me just confirm something. I haven't misunderstood. We had a long discussion about mortgage-related business, and that was everything I thought we had to do with mortgages. But you're saying in prop trading, there could have been some mortgages.
He asked the general prop trading question. I didn't think we were focused on mortgages.
No.
I was talking generally. The prop trading business is not mortgages. It's
So we got the whole picture.
Yes.
You didn't make a killing over here.
No.
All right. Thank you.
No. And the truck training business isn't big enough to make a killing.
Okay.
It's not mortgages, but it's not. It's small.
Right. Size wise, can we? We'll talk about it after.
Yeah.
Okay.
We're going to be doing a survey probably in the next day or two of as many of the hedge funds that will care to answer. One of the things we're trying to find out is what clients did, what customers, investors in the various hedge funds did, as far as yanking money out, because that's one of the propagation mechanisms that may have caused the asset values to decline when everybody was dumping to get liquid. How much of that did you see? Do you think was there an extraordinary client demand for liquidity to pull out of your, where you were actually managing money for clients firm-wide? Do you have a sense of how big, how unusual that was since the fall of 08?
I'm not sure I'm going to answer your question, but I'll try. There was a tremendous amount of de-risking and de-leveraging that went on across the system in the fall of 08. And sure, that accelerated the downward spiral. Everybody, and there were, part of it was because of risk aversion. Part of it was hedge funds and other funds fearing and actually having money pulled out, and therefore they were liquidating things so that they would have the money to pay the withdrawals. And yeah, that, and of course, when there's leverage in the system and that happens, it causes things to go down even faster, and I think that was a big part of what happened.
You can't really put any statistical, it's just a subjective...
Not that I'm aware of. Mm-hmm. I certainly would.
We've been going for a while, but I know Tom has maybe 5-10 minutes more. We could take a break now, or just kind of...
Okay, I'd rather finish.
I'll be real quick.
Sure.
You referred to the 1994 events and the way that basically impressed, particularly on a partnership at that time, the need to be careful about risk. And then you went public in 99, and the situation's been described to me that about your top 400 partners are paid, or 400 managing directors, the top 400 are paid like partners, except you don't have your personal stake at risk the way it was with a partnership. And my question really is, because what you described, and I love it, the shifting back and forth from the risk side to the trading side and so on, what you described is culture. And my question really is the extent to which that culture may become attenuated as you get farther and farther away from partnership. Let me say that one of the people we talked to, and I'd be interested in your reaction, said, well, Goldman used to be long-term greedy. I think that was Mr. Levy's expression for it. But now they're short-term greedy. And I'm sort of curious your perception of that culture and how one manages that.
Okay. So I can answer what's going to happen over time. Don't know. I can only tell you what's happened. And again, just to step back, if you go back to when we went public, there were very, very, very long debates about should Goldman Sachs go public. But what it really came down to was culture versus capital. That was, when you boil it all down, it was, could we operate as a global financial institution with partnership capital versus would our culture really be diminished if we went public? And ultimately, we made the conclusion that we should do it. And I think from a capital point of view, it's very clear we could not have operated as a private partnership. And we had $6 billion of capital when we were private, and it couldn't grow fast because when partners left, they took the money out. And so, maybe we have 10 now. We have 70. And we couldn't operate as a global financial institution without capital, so we know that. From a culture point of view, it was interesting to me, and I will admit bias here, is I think many of us, those of us who are still here, are surprised that the culture has been as strong as it's been. Now, again, there was a lot of conversation outside of it when the public was that, yes, we're worried about the culture, but, firms before they went public had different cultures too. Even when everyone was private, Goldman Sachs and Salomon Brothers had different cultures. And so why shouldn't we have a different culture in the public? First of all, the culture of Goldman Sachs, the teamwork nature, the cooperative nature, and we talked about it's just ingrained. We only, you know, you hire people. Those people who are doing the hiring are that way, and so you hire people who are that way. They're only successful if they're that way. It continues on. We underestimated one really important cultural thing to the positive, and that was when we were a partnership, we had 221 partners, so we had 221 owners. It was great if you were one of the 221 owners. At the time, we had roughly 14,000 people, so if you're one of the other 13,800 people, you weren't an owner. Now, every person in Goldman Sachs is an owner. Everybody gets equity as part of their compensation, and everybody has to hold that equity for a period of time. It really energized people to be owners of the firm. The partners still have, if not all of their net worth, like when we're partners, a substantial portion of their net worth tied up in the firm. Because the more longer you're a partner, the more your compensation, the greater percentage gets paid in equity, and you have to hold it for a long time. So people are still very tied up in the firm. The thing that is the most difficult thing for our culture is not going public, it's growth. Because Goldman Sachs is a very small company culture in a big company. As I said before, we thrive on communication. You go, you live with a client, you leave a voicemail for 25 people. You want to talk to people all over the world. That's easy when you're a small firm in one location. It's harder when you have 30,000 people, which to me is still a big company, you know, in many locations around the world. And so we have to do some things more formally than we had to do before. When I started, I know I'm dating myself, when I started, my training was the vice president who I was working on the deal with walked over to my desk, said, here's the book from the last deal we did, read this, and we're starting tomorrow. Now, people come in, they have a week-long training session, they learn lots of things. We have leadership training sessions, we have what's called Goldman Sachs University, so we do a lot more formal training and mentoring and communication skills that you have to do with a small company, because that stuff is harder when you get bigger. But as far as the partnership culture, the risk culture, the authority of the support side of business hasn't changed one bit.
So you differ with this person who said you've gone short term.
Completely and totally different.
Okay. Good.
Tom, can I see, did they give you an example? What would signify that we were short term greed?
They didn't, but in the context I would have to say it was probably something like reputational risk and what's going on in Washington. I don't know the answer.
I
have to go back and ask, because we had that argument on the train going up.
Always tend to look back with rose-colored glasses.
Yeah.
You only remember the good part. Partnership was great, but it wasn't perfect.
I'm thinking of a talk that...
I can give you chapter and verse on the issues with the partnership, too. I mean, it was not perfect. There were intergenerational issues. There were many issues with the partnership. It was great.
Mm-hmm.
There are issues with being a public company as well. I mean, there's issues with everything.
I'm always smiling because I had Arthur Levin come and speak to the legal department, and he's just very interesting man, obviously. And he was chuckling over the same point because... He said, because he knew the old Goldman Sachs very well, obviously, given his career, it's very lengthy. And he said, today, the stuff we do culturally to get things right and all of that is, you know, probably standard deviations better. And so there's a real rose-colored tint. But that goes back to David and I were, you know, partners at the same time. You know, there were less partners. It's a much smaller firm. And, you know, and if you went even 5 years before that, it would have been 50 partners.
Right.
Okay, you know, so it's very different. And so that's different because, you know, 50 partners, you really do get to know everyone really.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
When you move to 400, you don't know them quite as well. So as David said, we spent huge amounts of time and energy on things to try to make sure culture is imbued everywhere and watched. But the other thing that's fascinating to me is, I made this comment before. I still remember some of the people on our management committee who came from other firms, okay? Mm-hmm. And the people we get and that rose to that level, I thought they were born at Goldman Sachs, even though in some cases the firms they came from, in theory, their culture is supposed to be, you know, supposed to be bad, but maybe that's why they left, okay? Because
mm-hmm.
there is this virtuous circle I mentioned before, which is very, very helpful of being able to accomplish that. We used to go, people were optimistic about the future, maybe you weren't. They used to say public versus private, same picture, new frame. But really what we were trying to do was to, and you said to grow, but really the financial stability of the firm was what we were really focused on. Because 94, you know, as you've read and otherwise, lots of partners retired and your capital suddenly is just going to start draining. And permanent capital is just very, very, very important. You can't.
We needed permanent capital. The firm had reached its limit of size without permanent capital.
Mm-hmm. You know, and the scale would be global, as David referred to, which was our choice. We could have decided to be a bespoke, small, niche boutique.
Thank you.
Okay, sorry.
Thank you. Now, this has been most helpful to us.
Can I ask you, am I allowed this question?
Okay, sure, of course. David, you can do whatever you want.
So you, when we started talking about the mortgages and the P&L and the short, you said that there was a common leaf out there and that you knew we believed it was a misconception, and could I help clear it up? And I went through some numbers. Did I help clear it up?
I think you did. Very well. Thank you.
Thank you. Because that's... I know there's a lot of the stuff that's important. That's really important to me.
Well, it's important to us because we're trying to figure out what the cause of the financial
crisis. You worked hard on our white paper just as an aside, but it got totally ignored.
Well, I've noticed that. That's where I didn't know.